I would think that a lot of the conditions still prevail. Living on a farm, although you have modern highways and you have automobiles, you have radio and television, I will comment on that. That is an important difference. You can reach places. But still, the daily rhythm of the farm requires your presence on the farm. You know, you can't go gallivanting. And even the small town that you can get at with your highway and your new car still doesn't have a variety of cultural institutions. That is, what's available in the form of community life, I don't think is that much different than it was 100 years ago. Television, I would argue, is the major difference, because you can sit in your living room and see what's going on in Vietnam and see what's going on in New York City and London and whatever. And so you do have a broader sense of the world. If you lived in a farm or on the prairie in the 1870s, you had no notion what was going on in San Francisco or in Chicago or New York. You were really isolated. The world and you were really quite separate.
Except for some of the publications you mentioned, perhaps.
Right, but even that would come 3-4 weeks later. The mail was slow and irregular. Your contact with the outside world would be really limited. Today it's not. Everybody can watch Walter Cronkite on CBS News and have a sense that they know what's going on all over the world. So that is an important difference. In that sense, the prairies are not isolated. But still, in terms of the daily rhythm of a woman's life on that farm, on the prairies, I would think that there are more similarities than not to previous days.
One of the things some of the farm women I've talked to say when I ask them about their roles is that women have always been very important, and they see themselves as a very vital part of running the business operation of the farm, for example. So are you saying that they continue on having had some say-so on what was happening, or is this something more recent?
Well, no, I would agree that women have always been important. You couldn't operate the farm without them. They're absolutely essential to the survival and to the continuity and the prosperity. But I'm just suggesting, and they should justly be proud of their lives, and if they enjoy the roles they play, so be it. I'm not suggesting that everyone leave the prairies and leave the farms. I'm simply suggesting that the roles women have played and continue to play have pretty much been the expected cultural roles, and that very few little girls have ever been given the opportunity to think, what do I want to do with my life? There's never been that kind of questioning. Little boys are asked, do you want to be farmers, firemen, lawyers, doctor, if you're naturally good at science, or you want to be a mathematician or whatever. I mean, there's a notion of choice of your adult life as having a number of possibilities. That has never been the case with women. The assumption is that wife, mother is the full-time adult occupation. Probably for most of the women living on the prairies and the frontier to this day, that indeed is the full-time life. But maybe there, and I don't know, you'd know better than I, the statistics of farmers' daughters who are leaving the farms, the prairies, who aren't interested in repeating the life cycle of their mothers. But I would think those who've done it should be proud of their work. They shouldn't feel their lives have been useless or worthless. I'm not suggesting that at all. They've been important lives, but the element of choice has not been in it. That's the point.
I guess one of my observations is that there have always been strong women in just about every culture and so forth, and that given the repressive conditions and so forth, there were always women who were willing to speak out and be assertive and so forth. Is heredity more important or environmental background than anything else? And maybe I could ask you the question of, you know, what your own background is, ask you something about your own mother and your own grandmother.
Mm-hmm. It's a very important question, one that I'm very interested in. What makes women rebels? What makes strong women? How do you create this? I think it is a combination of genetic and environment. That is, I think unique personality is a trait that you're born with if you're lucky to have the right combination of parents. But then you need the right kind of cultural background, too. You need encouraging parents, or at least one parent who says you can be and do what you want. And it's interesting, when you look at the women of the past who've been the leaders in various organizations, they've usually been women who've had fathers who've encouraged them to study, to work, and so on. In my own case, I'd say both my parents. I'm a twin. I have a twin sister, and we're the only two children in the family. And both my mother and father always assumed that we would go to college and we would do what we wanted to do. There was never any pressure. For example, we both got liberal arts degrees, and there was never the assumption we had to take education courses just in case you didn't marry or because you needed a practical occupation, and neither of us did. The assumption was we could be and do what we wanted to. I always wanted to write. I never thought I'd become a college professor, but I always wanted to write, which I am doing, and I always like to talk and lecture. So I'm really am doing things that I had always kind of thought about, but I must say that a lot of my adult life has been, converting talent and opportunity into good fortune. The reason I went to graduate school and became a college teacher is I had an opportunity to, there was this new school opening up in Chicago, and I just had a master's degree in history, and I had no college teaching, no teaching experience. I'd had 1 or 2 years of working as a writer and really no, you know, major career plans. I still didn't really know what I was doing. I went to graduate school because I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I had a chance to teach at this college. And once I got there, I found that I really enjoyed college teaching, that I really hadn't any idea what teaching was all about. And I discovered also very quickly that they made it very clear to me that if I wanted to teach, I'd have to go on and get an advanced degree and get a PhD. And so while I was teaching, I got a PhD. And then one thing has led to another in the last 10 years, because I've been teaching for 10 years now. In other words, the college teaching has, and the going back to graduate school got me very interested in women. My dissertation topic was on feminism in the 1910s. So all of these things were kind of fortuitous. If I didn't get this college teaching job, which I hadn't studied or planned for, I wouldn't have gone for a PhD, and I wouldn't have done research on women, and I wouldn't have become a woman's historian. So in that sense, it's a lucky congruence of different circumstances that have brought it together. But I would say that my parents have been a positive influence in the sense that they always were encouraging.
People talk about the women's liberation movement as a monolith. And what are your own views on what this movement might consist of right now? What some of the forces, what some of the major forces are in it, and what impact it might be having on our society right now?
Well, I think it's a very diverse and rich assortment of organizations and causes. As you well know, the press has generally been negative to the women's liberation movement, and the way to disavow and really repudiate a movement is you put on television some of the most militant and radical spokeswomen for the cause in a way to downgrade it and to degrade the movement. I mean, it's done not because the media wants to encourage or respectfully look at the issues of women's liberation, but rather to criticize it. I think, although you do have militants, and I think militants have a right to be, if you believe in free speech in this country, you have to believe in all shades of opinion being expressed, and I believe in that. But within the women's movement today, and I rather call it, I guess, the women's movement rather than the women's liberation movement, because I think it is a broader term. You have the ERA people, you have an organization like NOW, which some people call the NAACP of the women's movement. It's for very specific changes in legislation, improving social security laws for women and widows, getting rid of discriminatory laws, enforcing affirmative action programs. So you have a range. You have those women who are working for specific legislative change, those who want to see abortion remain on the books, those who want the passage of the Equal Rights Amendment, lesbians who want their rights protected. It's a tremendous spectrum. There is a core of ideas, I would argue, that all feminists and all members of the women's movement agree to. They agree that women should be treated equally in the eyes of the law. And in many cases, they would argue, I guess, there should be special treatment for a period of time until women have caught up. There should be changes in the school system so that young girls are given equal opportunity to develop themselves as little boys. I think most women who call themselves feminists agree with these ideas. Some are not willing to consider minority rights, lesbians and gay men. I consider minority in both the women's movement and, let's say, the male liberation movement. I think both sexes are working toward and should be working toward a more open, frank set of relationships between them, where people meet each other on a more equal basis. Women need a lot of changing, and I think there has to be a lot of change in the society to raise their expectations, to give them new dreams.
What are some of the ways of giving them new dreams besides people like you going around and trying to prick their consciousness?
Well, that's obviously one way, but I think you've got to see the school publishers, the school book publishers, changing the little Dick and Jane readers that always show the girl sitting there as Dick is doing all the neat things. You've got to remove all the stereotypes from the elementary school books. You have to change the teachers' attitudes, who still do think that boys are mischievous and that's okay, and little girls are quiet and obedient. You have to educate parents to a more open way of raising children of both sexes. Toys should be de-sexized so that it's not, you don't have just mechanical toys for boys and dolls for girls. I see every stage of life requiring change and every level of society needing change.
And what is the time span for those kinds of changes?
Oh, I think it's three more generations before we're really going to see a feminist society.
What is your assessment of the success or failure of affirmative action to this point?
Well, it's had a very mixed record. I think there have been some institutions that have been sincerely trying to recruit women and minority group members, and there have been others who haven't, and some of them are under suit now, and there's litigation against them. The fact that the economy is in a bad way hurts affirmative action programs because they're simply cutting back on job opportunities, and so that's going to hurt women and minority groups who are the last ones hired and therefore the first ones fired. I think that there is a real serious controversial issue here. A lot of people who see themselves as liberals are against quotas, and they're against favorable or favorite preferential treatment for some groups. And affirmative action essentially says that it's favor treatment to a certain extent, but not entirely. Affirmative action argues that if you have two equally qualified candidates, you should take the woman or member of a minority group over the white male. Now, white men feel that that's discrimination against them. But the answer to that is that, number one, that the woman or the black or the Chicano has to be of equal qualifications so that you can't argue that. You're not choosing inferior qualifications over superior ones. But secondly, although the white males who are living at this time may not be personally guilty of sexism, just as the majority of whites today may not be guilty of racism, nevertheless, these are isms that have been perpetuated in this culture. And there has to be a point when someone says, no, it can't go on any longer, we must make conscious efforts to change it. If you don't make conscious efforts to change, and affirmative action is an attempt at a conscious effort, nothing ever will change.
Someone from HEW suggested that perhaps minorities and women might be at odds fighting over some of the jobs that affirmative action might gain for them. Is this the case?
Well, I don't see it happening immediately, but I think it is a possibility that if, as I say, there's a shrinking employment market and there are few jobs to be gotten, then it may be women and the minorities fighting over the few jobs, which would be really sad and really tragic. But I can see it happening.
And as you suggested before, it may be two or three generations before people can gain a job on the merits or on their own personal qualifications.
That's right. In the best of all possible worlds, you will judge people on their merits. But that world doesn't exist today. And until it does, you need governmental encouragement and insistence that all publicly supported, tax-supported institutions must be equal in their hiring practices.